This is the second hour of the program, and in this hour, we'll be talking about research and development of cold fusion as an energy source. Now, nuclear fusion is the process that powers the sun, and some scientists think that if we could somehow find a way to harness that process, in effect, put it in a bottle, we would gain tremendous amounts of energy. The technical problems associated with doing that, however, are enormous, and I think that no one expects that those problems will be solved anytime very soon, if ever. However, there are other scientists that believe that fusion is possible at or near room temperature. A little bit easier, although that idea in some people's minds remains controversial about whether or not, indeed, cold fusion would ever be practical as an energy source. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with a scientist who's been doing research in this area for some time. His name is Edmund Storms. He has a PhD in radiochemistry from Washington University in St. Louis, and for 34 years worked at Los Alamos National Laboratory. His work there involved doing basic research in the field of high-temperature chemistry as applied to materials used in nuclear power and propulsion reactors. He's also had also done that time at Los Alamos, done studies of the cold fusion effect. Right now, he makes his home in Santa Fe, and he continued to investigate the cold fusion effect in his own laboratory. And in fact, he now is a senior scientist for a company called Lattice Energy LLC that hopes to commercialize this process. As we talk with Dr. Storms, you're certainly welcome to give us a call and ask questions. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. So, again, 333-WILL for Champaign-Urbana listeners, toll-free 800-222-WILL. At any point here, people who have questions are welcome to call. All we ask of callers is people just try to be brief, and we do that so that we can get in as many callers as possible and keep the program moving along. Dr. Storms, hello.
Yes, good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity.
I appreciate it. Well, this is something that that we're curious about. We like to indulge our curiosity now and again, particularly when it's things that we feel we really don't understand. So this will be an opportunity, I hope, to feel at the end of the program we understand better than the beginning. And I have to admit that I'm someone who has never studied physics and did somehow manage to make it through Chemistry 101, but that's about the extent of my scientific background. So if you can explain this so that I'll understand it, I think probably a lot of people will be able to understand it.
Well, I'll try to do that. It's a little bit difficult sometimes, but we'll give it a shot.
Well, let me ask you then to start in a very basic way to talk about what is fusion?
Well, fusion is the nuclear process that involves two nuclei coming together to make a third nuclei. And in the case of the cold fusion phenomena and the hot fusion phenomena as well, it's two deuterons. Deuterons are the nucleus of an isotope of hydrogen. Ordinary hydrogen that makes water has three isotopes. It's one of them is called protium, which has one proton as the nucleus in the nucleus. There's deuterium that has one proton and one neutron, and then there's tritium, which has one proton and two neutrons, which is radioactive, and it's involved in nuclear weapons frequently. When two deuterons come together and fuse, they can make a number of different products, and one of these products is helium, ordinary helium that you have in, you know, balloons. It can also make a number of other products which are involved or products that occur during what's called the hot fusion reaction. And the hot fusion reaction is a technique that is presently being studied and is a big plant is being built in France now to do that. But it's a different aspect of it, but it's still the same phenomena, two nuclei coming together to make a third nuclei.
All right. And energy is produced in the process.
Yes, a lot of energy is produced in the process because when this happens, mass, the third nuclei has less mass than the sum of the two initial nuclei, and that mass is converted into energy.
Mm-hmm. And this, I hope I was correct at the beginning where I started out saying essentially this is what happens in the sun.
Yes, that's one of the many nuclear reactions that occurs in the sun. And in hydrogen bombs also, if you want to get more close to home.
So that then, I guess, would suggest the difficulty for if you decided, well, you wanted to try and do hot fusion as a means of generating energy, that essentially then what you would have to do is find some way to contain what's going on either in the sun or, I suppose, in a hydrogen bomb in some kind of container so that you would contain that reaction and be able to siphon off the energy. I'm sure, no small thing.
That's the big challenge, because the hot fusion technique uses what's called a plasma, and a plasma is just simply a collection of very energetic ions. And that's necessary because in order to for the fusion reaction to occur, the Coulomb barrier must be overcome. Now, the Coulomb barrier exists because all nuclei have a positive charge. And if you stayed awake during your physics lectures, you know that positive charges repel. And somehow or another, you've got to overcome that repulsion. The hot fusion technique does this by brute force. Mm-hmm. They just heat something up really hot and then smack the two together hard enough that barrier is overcome. And, of course, the plasma has to be held in some manner during that process, and since it is so hot that it would melt and vaporize any material known to man, it must be held in what's called a magnetic bubble. And that requires a very large machine and a great deal of energy to maintain that bubble, and that's been the real problem with the hot fusion technique.
Mm-hmm. So is the big problem that, I mean, obviously, we, on the one hand, we have a very significant technical challenge, but is the greater issue with hot fusion that it takes more energy than it produces?
That's been the case so far. Of course, the intention of all this effort is to reverse that output and have it make more than it uses. Unfortunately, they've worked on this for quite a while and spent many billions of dollars and have not succeeded yet, and are not certain that they can succeed. And there are a number of people, not just in the cold fusion field, you know, out of self-interest, that don't believe they can succeed. So the cold fusion field, in contrast, initiates this fusion reaction in a different environment. And this different environment has characteristics about it that do not require this high energy. And that's what makes it so attractive, but at the same time, it makes it so difficult for the people in normal physics to believe, because it's not the kind of environment that they're used to seeing things happen in. And they're not used to dealing with those kinds of issues.
So, and again, just to make sure people understand here, as far as we can leave hot fusion for a moment, there is research going on there, has been, as you say, a lot of money has gone into it. The results haven't been what people in the field would like, but we expect that's probably going to keep going. But now here is another way of doing it, doing fusion that works in a different way. That I'm sure there also are technical challenges here, but it's you don't have to worry about working at those extremely high temperatures that you do when you're doing hot fusion.
That's exactly right.
So now, and is there, for people who are doing, like you, for people who are doing cold fusion, experimenting with that, is there more than one way to do this, or is it essentially the one kind of process with perhaps different kinds of approaches to it?
No, that's one of the beauties of it. There's, I would say, four or five different techniques with variations that produce the same effects. The Pons-Fleischmann technique, which used an electrolytic cell and placed the deuterium into palladium at very high equivalent pressures, that's the classic technique, and that's the one many people have studied. But there are a number of others as well, including gas discharge, just simply gas ion bombardment, sonic techniques. And more amazingly, it's found that if you have created this, what I call a nuclear active environment, that's the special material that has the properties to initiate, to host these nuclear reactions, if you successfully make that, then all you need to do is put it into deuterium, and it will spontaneously catalyze these nuclear reactions. You don't have to do anything more.
Well, just going back to, again, I'm asking this really basic question. You talked about the fact that essentially what you're doing here is you're gaining energy by fusing these two hydrogen isotopes to two deuterons. You end up with some helium, and there's a lot of energy released. And the problem, though, as you explained it, that much I know, is you have a problem with two particles who have like charges. They're going to repel each other. The opposites attract, the likes don't. So that's the issue, how it is you get that to happen. In hot fusion, you do it one way, and it's extreme. It takes a lot of energy, and it happens at very high temperature. And how is it that you manage to make this happen in a cold way?
Well, there's two questions there implicit in your one question. The one is how do we measure how do we know it happens at all? And the other is what initiates it? What's different about this environment? And let's talk about that first. The cold fusion reaction is initiated in a solid lattice, generally a metal, and a solid lattice of a metal or a solid piece of metal consists of atoms that are arranged in a regular array. They're in a crystalline structure so that the atoms have a periodicity associated with them. In addition to that, they also have a high concentration of electrons that are there that can form wave structures. And those two characteristics, the periodicity of the lattice and the presence of the electrons, are thought to generate a condition within the lattice that neutralizes the Coulomb barrier and allows the two deuterium nuclei to come close enough together to fuse. Now, as for knowing what happens and why and when it happens, the most used and the simplest technique is to measure the heat using what's called calorimetry. Heat measurement is that kind of measurement is very well known. It's been used for almost 200 years now. The techniques now are very highly developed. You know when you're making a normal amount of heat. The problem there is that it's not the kind of measurement that most physicists are comfortable with, nor do they fully respect the results. They like to see particles. They like to see radiation. That's what is characteristic of the fusion reaction under high energy conditions. The difference between the two really is that there is very little radiation given off under the cold fusion conditions. It's just heat and then the helium. And you can measure the helium. That doesn't come off as particles, but you can measure it as a gas, and that's been measured. And there's a small amount of radiation that's generated, but it's so weak that you have to measure it within the cell, within the device itself. And if there's any barrier between you and the source, it's absorbed. That's really great from the point of view of its use and study. I mean, if it were as high a source of radiation as hot fusion, I'd be dead by now. I mean, you cannot study such things in a trivial way. But the cold fusion reaction does not give off any radiation. As a result, it's a very safe source of energy. But at the same time, it's a very difficult source of energy to investigate because you don't have those diagnostic tools available to you.
But it does. You're saying that it does produce measurable heat.
Yes, it produces measurable heat.
Does it get you more energy than it costs to produce it?
There have been a few occasions when that's been the case. Generally speaking, that's not the case because the experiments are designed to get information about the process and are not maximized to give you highest efficiency for heat production.
But you believe that it is possible it would be possible to build a device that would demonstrate this effect and that indeed you would get more energy out than you put in.
Yes, and this is sort of like asking the Wright brothers you know, they've just taken off, and you're asking them, well, how soon can we see transatlantic flight?
I understand. It's early days, as they say.
Yeah, it's early days. It's very clear that the process is real. That, I think, there's no rational debate that can be applied to it. It is real. Now, the only area where there's debate now is how you explain it. And then, of course, how do you magnify the effect to a point where it could be commercially useful?
Mm. And you think that that is possible, that there is potential for developing this as a way of commercially producing energy?
Oh, absolutely. Any phenomena that is proven to be real can be made commercially useful. I mean, we see that this happen all the time. The transistor, not too many years ago, was considered a novelty. And now it's the basis for the whole computer industry.
Well, I have a caller. I want to get them on here. And also for people who have just tuned in, I want to introduce again our guest. We're talking with Dr. Edmund Storms. He's a researcher in the area of cold fusion. He was, for 34 years, a scientist at Los Alamos National Laboratory, where he did various kinds of work, including some studies on cold fusion. He now makes his home in Santa Fe, and he is investigating the cold fusion effect in his own laboratory. He is a senior scientist for a company called Lattice Energy LLC. That's a company that intends to commercialize the process of cold fusion for energy. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's someone in Eureka, line number 4. Hello.
Good afternoon, or good morning, Dr. Storms. I'm so lost in the technical details, I don't think I'd ever understand it. But my question has to do with, I believe, about 15, 18 years ago in Utah, there was a national news or controversy about the state of Utah had given out millions of dollars to someone, and I don't know if it was to any universities. Did anything ever come of this? Was there any, was it just basically a scam or a con? And is there any good research going on right now that you think may be marketable in the near future, especially in light of the current energy difficulties?
Well, here, no doubt the caller is referring to Stanley Pons and Martin Fleischmann.
I see. Okay. I thought the name sounded familiar.
That's right. Those are the two men at the University of Utah. This was in 1989. It did indeed get a lot of national attention. And there was seemed to be some controversy about did they in fact demonstrate cold fusion? Were they mistaken? Was there some fraud involved? And I know that this is something that our guest, Dr. Storms, has looked at and written about. So let's give him the chance here to talk a little bit about Pons and Fleischmann.
I'll take the answer off the air.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Well, Pons and Fleischmann were the two scientists who announced to the world the existence of this phenomena. They were working at the University of Utah at the time. Stanley Pons was the head of the chemistry department, and Fleischmann was on sabbatical leave from England. The once this was announced, a great deal of attention was paid to it, and it was one of the most widely advertised scientific discoveries of modern time, and generated a tremendous amount of interest, not the least of which was at Los Alamos National Laboratory, I might add, where we worked very hard to try to replicate what they had done and succeeded on a number of occasions. But the work that they described was real. It was not fraudulent. It was, as all early work is, somewhat confused, not nearly as well understood as it needed to be for that kind of attention, and that was one of the objections that the skeptics love to point out. The state of Utah did give money to set up a laboratory to try to extend the work. They succeeded in replicating a number of the claims that Pons and Fleischmann had made, but there was so much antagonism in the general scientific profession that grew over time, that laboratory was shut down. Pons and Fleischmann later were supported in Nice, France, by Technova, which is a company of Toyota Motor Company, And they worked there for several years and developed the technique further for the Japanese. The work presently is going on now in seven countries throughout the world, some countries at a fairly high level and with government support. In Italy, Japan, Russia, there's a large program growing in China. I mean, all of these programs are being stimulated by the obvious need for energy, and we're certainly going to are beginning to suffer that the consequences of our energy policy right now. But these countries have looked ahead and have jumped into studying the cold fusion effect with the intention of developing it as a source of energy. It's very real, it's ongoing, and there's a tremendous amount of information. If you wish to read about it, I can give you a website, if you have a pencil handy, where you can get all this information. It's all available. And the website is www.lenr-canr.org. The letters stand for Low Energy Nuclear Reaction, Chemically Assisted Nuclear Reaction.
Okay, very good. So definitely to answer the caller's question, yes, there are many places where there is serious work going on where they believe that it is a potential, a commercially, something that can be potentially developed commercially, and there are governments that are putting money into that. So there are definitely people who would think who are very serious about it and indeed think that there is something here. With Pons and Fleischmann, one of the grounds on which they were criticized was for going public with what they felt they had in the way that they did, bypassing the usual kind of peer review process where they would have written papers, they would have gone to conferences, a lot of other scientists would have looked at what they had, and people would have gone, obviously in science, just demonstrating something one time isn't good enough. You've got to demonstrate it a number of times, and if then somebody comes along and tries to do it and it doesn't work, then that raises question with the whole business to start. So they didn't do that, and for that they were criticized. And perhaps from that then is the impression that people might have gained that in fact they didn't demonstrate cold fusion at all. What really was the big problem with Pons and Fleischmann? And was it, as you say, just the fact that this was early on in the course of research, and early on maybe you're not quite sure what you're doing, and maybe indeed you would agree that they should not have gone public at the time that they did?
Well, there's a story behind that, and it's one of the sad ironies of modern time, actually, that one of the greatest discoveries made in this century was initiated in the peculiar way that this one was. I'll just give you a little background. Pons and Fleischmann were working on this program for several years using their own money, and they had come to the conclusion that it was too big for them to investigate with their own resources. So they put in a proposal to the DOE to get some money from the government, which is the ordinary routine thing for people to do. It was ironic, perhaps, that Stephen Jones at BYU was working on a program that was somewhat similar. He was trying to demonstrate that the heat of the Earth is generated by a fusion reaction. And he had set up a cell where he was trying to detect neutrons, which is the normal thing to detect from this fusion reaction. That's what you would expect before Pons and Fleischmann came along to see being produced. He wasn't looking for heat. The DOE knew about his work and sent him Pons and Fleischmann's proposal for peer review. Well, Jones recognized that they were essentially studying the same phenomena, and this was world-class idea. I mean, this was new Nobel Prize-winning kinds of work, and he was in an awkward position. But he did tell Pons and Fleischmann that he was working on it also and was planning to publish a paper on what he was doing. Well, the officials at University of Utah realized that if Jones went public with this, he would get all the credit for it. And they didn't want to see that happen. So they set up this news conference over Pons and Fleischmann's objection. I mean, Fleischmann said that, no, this is too early, this is not appropriate. And they said, well, you either show up or not, it doesn't matter, we're going to announce this to the world. So they showed up, and they announced it to the world, and the sorry chain of events went downhill from there. But the one of the things, though, is that that by itself, I don't think, was the poison. The poison to the field was the difficulty in replicating and the inability of normal science to explain it. And science these days is driven very strongly by theory. And if you don't have a good explanation for what you're observing, it's very, well, it's almost universally rejected. That's the characteristic of science these days. In the past, experimental observation was the primary reality. Now, theory is the primary reality. And this has proven to be very difficult to replicate. Not impossible, but very difficult. And it's only been in recent times that people have discovered how to replicate it on a fairly regular basis. But back then, it could not be. I mean, at Los Alamos, for example, there was probably a dozen efforts to, well, maybe a dozen and a half efforts to try to replicate it. Only three succeeded. And I happened to be one of them, and that's what kept me in the field. If I had failed, I probably wouldn't be talking to you today.
We have a caller here I want to get to, and perhaps I should again introduce our guest, Dr. Edmund Storms. He is retired from Los Alamos National Lab. He worked there 34 years, involved in research on high-temperature chemistry is applied to materials used in nuclear power and propulsion reactors, and he also did some studies of the cold fusion effect. He now makes his home in Santa Fe, where he's investigating the cold fusion effect in his own laboratory. He is the senior scientist for Lattice Energy, LLC. That's a company that intends to, or hopes to, commercialize the cold fusion process as an energy-generating technique. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers here, someone on a cell phone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. I had read earlier this year that DOE had some kind of review of cold fusion, and I was wanting to know what their conclusions were, if you could talk a little bit about that report.
Well, yes, they... We're persuaded to give it another evaluation. They set this up in a somewhat peculiar way, which did not lend itself to the information being presented to them in the most effective manner. The result of this was that they concluded pretty much the same that they had concluded after the ERAD panel, the original one, and that was there was something strange going on. It was not proven sufficiently that it deserved any kind of special support, but if people wish to put proposals into the DOE for consideration, it would go through the normal review process and be supported in the normal manner. And that pretty much got them off the, you know, out of the, how would I put it? It made it look as if they were being sympathetic without actually having to do anything.
So they aren't really supporting much in the way of cold fusion?
No. The DOE, as far as I know, a number of people have put in proposals. So far as I know, none of them have been supported at this point.
So all of the funding really is basically private here in this country?
Yes. There are other government agencies that are involved. The Navy, for example, gave a lot of support to the study of cold fusion. DARPA, the Defense Department agency for giving money to these kinds of things, gave money and is presently giving money. Most of the money is coming, at least in the United States, from private sources.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks. You mentioned, Dr. Storms, that in other countries there was research going on and that those governments of other countries were funding that research. Is it possible to make some kind of rough comparison between the amount of money that goes into cold fusion research in the United States compared with the amount of money that is going into it other places around the world?
Only in a very general way. The amount of money that's being put into it is not advertised, certainly not in the United States. in other countries, they tend to be a little bit quiet about it, too. Part of that is because there's a negative feeling, there's skepticism everywhere. I mean, even the countries that are supporting the work, even in Japan and China, Italy and Russia, there are skeptics. And you don't want to rub their nose into the fact that money is being put into this, something that they think is just a waste of time. So people who are funding this work tend to do it as quietly as possible. The result of that is that all you can do is see how much is being done based upon how many people from that particular country show up at the international conferences. There's ICCF 12 is coming up in November, and it will be held in Japan. The last one was held in Marseille, France. That was ICCF 11. The biggest contingent is usually from Japan, and because the Japanese have been very have gotten into this very strongly and have been working on it from the very beginning. The other countries, Italy, there's a program that's within the Italy, the Italian Atomic Energy Laboratories, that is covered to some extent by money that's just given for general work. But it's ongoing and it's growing. The Chinese are very quiet about what they're doing, but obviously that's growing as well. All the countries that need energy are working very hard to try to develop this. The United States initially thought they needed no energy and paid no attention to it whatsoever. I'm hoping that that will change.
Hmm. Let us talk with another caller. This is someone in Urbana, here where we are, line number two.
Yeah,
hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
I followed the cold fusion breakthrough news, et cetera, back in 1989, somewhat closely when I was a physics student at San Francisco State University. There's a couple of things that I recall from those very early times was that, I had a couple of questions. I also, sorry to jump around a bit, read your recent article in Make magazine. In the article, you mentioned that the fusion processes seem to be tied up with surface defects and surface impurities. And what I recall from thinking about the possibilities for whether this would work on a technical basis or not a long time ago was that lattice periodicity, which you mentioned a little bit, might have something to do with it. It occurs to me that there might be a question about internal lattice defects, basically where one crystal cell boundaries up against another one, you know, lattice mismatches and so forth, that might act as the surface defects that you have introduced deliberately on the surface. Is there any possibility to any of this being technically useful, or have these questions been answered, and if so, how?
Well, practically every perturbation and combination and every concept that you can possibly think of has been suggested by somebody.
I can believe it.
Yeah, and there's, I mean, it's a vacuum. It's a theoretical vacuum, and that, you know, scientists abhor a theoretical vacuum, and so they work on. I mean, there's probably 500 papers on this website addressing various aspects of the theory. Now, as to that particular variation on the theory, yes, mismatch can certainly be imagined to produce abnormal conditions, but you need a bit more than that. You have to find some way of neutralizing the Coulomb barrier. And there's two basic ways that have been proposed. I mean, there's lots of others, but there's two basic ones. One is that the atoms are converted to waves by virtue of the periodicity of the lattice, and as waves they can interact without a Coulomb barrier, presumably. And the other is that the electrons can interact in such a way as to produce super concentrations of these electrons between the two positive charges to neutralize them and bring them together. Those are two conditions that would help account for how you could overcome that barrier. Then you have a third condition you have to worry about, and that is once the energy has been released, how does it get out into the world? How does it convert to heat without making radiation? Because if you have energetic particles bouncing around in a lattice, they will generate X-rays and other kinds of radiation, which are not seen. So there's another process that occurs that's unusual after the fusion reaction takes place. So you've got two essential characteristics that you've got to explain, and that's been a real challenge.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, I haven't followed this very closely in the 10 or 15 years since the early 90s, so I'm glad to see that there's some research doing something on it. I mean, it's such a small amount of money being spent on it. I hope something shows up for that amount of money. Certainly would be a good return on investment. All right.
Well, that's an interesting point, too, because at this stage, it doesn't take very much money to make real progress. And that's, of course, the great sadness of people who are in the field. They realize that a few million or tens of millions of dollars would generate huge advancements, whereas a few billion dollars in hot fusion will have practically no effect at all. And it would seem that the money is being misappropriated in that sense. Not that hot fusion should be stopped, but if we got 1% of the hot fusion budget, we could really make progress.
Well, other questions are welcome. We have about 15 minutes left in this hour of Focus 580. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number to call. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. As we have talked, you feel that with the kind of technique that you're using, that it is possible with refinement and fine-tuning to end up with something that will produce more energy than it consumes. So here we have something that likely might be a viable energy source, and certainly it has the advantages. We've talked about some of the advantages, the fact that, yes, maybe this reaction produces a tiny bit of radiation, but nothing like nuclear fission does. And it doesn't produce any harmful waste products that we have to deal with. So there are significant advantages. But and I have no idea what sort of scales we're talking about here, or how much in an experimental setting, how much energy you could produce. But in terms of scaling this up, I mean, if we were thinking about taking this technique and using it as the basis, say, for a commercial power plant, is that really reasonable to think about that? How big would such a facility have to be to generate as much energy as your average coal-burning power plant or your average nuclear reactor?
Well, that's an interesting question, because cold fusion allows you to think in terms of energy production in a different way than has been applied in the past. The region that's producing these nuclear reactions is really small. The energy density, that is the amount of energy coming out of a cubic centimeter of this active material, is on the probably well over 100,000 watts per cubic centimeter. And possibly even more than that.
100,000 watts per cubic centimeter?
That's right. And nobody's ever made something as big as a cubic centimeter. You're working with particles that are on the size of a few microns, a few millionths of a meter, cubic meter. So that's the only reason why everybody isn't dead, or my house hasn't blown up yet, is that it's occurring on a very, very small scale.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge is to make more of this active material. In a cell, only a very small fraction of the material is active. But that small fraction is producing a tremendous amount of energy for each little bit of it that's there. Now, if you could make more of it, then you could make a device produce as much energy as you wanted to. But because it has such a high energy density, you don't need very much of it. I mean, this is much higher energy density than a nuclear reaction, a nuclear reactor, you know, that produces energy in a conventional conventional fission reactor. So people are thinking now that the way to do this is to go small. You would, once you know how to make this stuff, this active material, put it into a bottle, put some deuterium into it, and every home would have a little box that would be maybe the size of a refrigerator that would provide all of the electricity, all of the heat for that home. And you'd no longer have to have centralized power plants. You no longer have to be connected to a grid with inefficient wire transmission. It would be thinking small rather than large. This would also mean that such power sources could be used in parts of the world where these grid systems, these transmission line systems, aren't in place. So the third world, every home could have this just simply by buying it and plugging it in. And then once a year, somebody would come around and take the canister out, put a fresh one in, and you'd have power again for a year.
Mm-hmm. What, in terms of raw materials, what sort of things do you need, and would that be a particular issue?
Well, you need two things. You need deuterium. That's the material that's used up.
Mm-hmm.
Deuterium is a naturally occurring isotope of hydrogen, approximately 6,000 parts per million of all water, rainwater, ocean water, river water, is deuterium water, and that is D2O. There's enough deuterium in the oceans to supply all of the world's needs for, well, millions of years. I mean, the amount is huge. So we essentially have an infinite supply of the source of energy. Now, the other material you need is the environment in which this fusion reaction occurs. And that the ideal environment hasn't been identified yet. Palladium is a good one and has been used. Palladium's fairly rare, but other metals have also supported the reaction, titanium being one, for example. So it's possible that as we understand better the characteristics of this environment, it could be made out of most anything.
All right, let's talk with another caller, Bloomington, Indiana, line number 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Hi, about energy density per cubic centimeter. I just made a quick calculation. That 100,000 watts per cubic centimeter, that's about 132 horsepower per cubic centimeter. How do you cool it? I mean, how can you run water past that kind of energy production fast enough so that the thing doesn't melt?
Well, because it's happening in a very small region, and in fact some of the regions do melt. The ones that are particularly effective in producing energy do melt. And
that's a problem, isn't it?
No, it's not a problem. You're talking in the real world. You're not talking about a single cubic centimeter. You're talking about a million little specks of the material of a few cubic microns, and they're distributed over a large area, so that there's plenty of opportunity for the heat to leave. And in an ordinary cold fusion cell, you don't have very many of these. That's why they're so inefficient. That's why the amount of energy that we get out is so small. It's been very difficult to know how to make more of this stuff. In the past, nature has made this pretty much by accident. At least an electrolytic cell, you electrolyze it for several months, and materials accumulated on the surface that gradually forms the necessary physical environment to support these nuclear reactions. But only a small fraction of the surface has acquired that material.
I see. Okay, well, that does comfort my mind.
Yeah, it comforts mine, too.
that, Thank you much.
All right. Sure. Thanks for the call. Again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We talked earlier about the fact that in other countries there are scientists who are working on this, and that some other countries, particularly those that are concerned with meeting their energy needs, the Japanese, for example, I think you said was the one that was at the top of the list, were putting significant resources into doing this kind of research. And certainly with a country like Japan, you can understand why they would. Not having any oil right now, depending pretty heavily on nuclear generation, not surprising that they would be investigating something like this. And that here in the United States, while there are scientists like you who are working on it, it's mostly funded by private sort of money coming from private sources, that apparently so far the Department of Energy has not decided to get into it in any big way, although there are some other government funding, particularly defense, I guess, has put some money into it. How many here in the United States, are there very many people who, like you, are doing this kind of research?
Yeah, there's probably, I'd say 100 people who are actively involved in some aspect of it, either messing around with it as students or looking at it in a more systematic and sustained way, like myself. It's not a very large group, and that, of course, is a big problem. Let's say, for the sake of argument, that one of us discovers how to make this nuclear active environment very efficiently, and all of a sudden we can make energy at any level we wish. Then what do you do? There's no intellectual infrastructure. There's no people trained in these concepts out there to go into a company and start putting this together to manufacture it. Almost everybody that would start doing that would have to essentially rediscover the wheel and train people in the right concepts. The problem, you see, is that we have all been trained, most of us in science, with a particular paradigm in mind, a particular attitude towards nuclear reactions. And that stands in the way of being able to accept some of the unusual things that you see happening and have to explain in the cold fusion environment. So you would have this problem of training people and changing their attitudes in order to apply this their skills and creativity to developing this further. And that is a slow process. The other countries that are going down this road now actively are training people, and they will have people who understand it and can develop it in place once these problems are solved.
Hmm. We'll try to get one more caller here, someone nearby in Savoy, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, hi, how you doing? Yeah, this is an interesting subject. You know, I'd like to kind of pick up on this one point where you said, you know, that a lot of science or a lot of research is aimed towards not so much producing experimental results, but producing, quote, understanding of certain processes or phenomenon. And, you know, one of the things that kind of hold me back about believing that cold fusion is possible is there's a lot of research going on where people go and say, you know, hey, you're just going to have to believe what the supercomputer says because we can't produce it in the laboratory for one reason or another. A good example is global warming. You've got a computer, you've got this supercomputer tied up doing these global simulations that go out maybe 5 centuries into the future, and they just say, well, you have to wait. Now, they've managed to convince governments, you know, that they want large sums of money for this. And, you know, that's one good example. And I kind of think cold fusion falls into this same category where it's something that you say is possible, but then you go and you say, well, I just can't. There's no way I can produce proof of it. And string theory is another good one where they go and they say, if you just give us some more money, we'll be able to understand it. But if you want us to conduct an experiment to prove it, you're out of luck.
Well, that's a good point. And for a long time, that point really did have a justification. Now, however, there's enough information available from all the work that's been done all over the world to demonstrate that, it's the issue of it being real is no longer rational. I mean, that has been decided already, and anybody who would like to prove to themselves that that's true can go to the website that I quoted a little earlier and read all the details. I mean, it's all there. You don't have to go to a library. You don't have to go off and do a lot of research on your own. It's there. You can read a review that I wrote recently called The Student's Guide to Cold Fusion, which summarizes all of this. And then you can go into the library on the website and read the original papers that are cited and come to your own conclusions. This is not an issue of being real or not real. It's an issue of whether or not we want to put resources into something that has almost a psychological, a mythological negativeness to it. And that's the same way with global warming, I might add. There's a myth that is being generated within the society that global warming is not occurring, because if it is occurring, the consequences to the economy and what we have to do something about it are too large, too great. People don't want to go down that road, and so they pretend that it isn't there. But anybody who does any research in this area, or even just looks at the glaciers and just looks at where the plants are growing now and where they didn't before, and just looks at the data, knows that global warming is occurring. The issue is how much of it is our fault, and not just being a natural phenomena. That's the only issue there.
I've got to jump in here, and we've got to save that for some other day, and to leave it here for the moment, and perhaps it's something we can get back to on another day, see how things develop. We want to say thanks to our guest, Edmund Storms. He is a retired scientist from Los Alamos National Lab. He now makes his home in Santa Fe, where he is investigating cold fusion in his own laboratory. He's the senior scientist for Lattice Energy, LLC, there. And Dr. Storms, thanks very much.
Well, thank you very much. It's a very interesting discussion.